crash. Soviet agents reported that the townspeople in Roswell had talked about little creatures at the crash site and a crescent-shaped aircraft that the army hauled away on trucks, but the stories had been quickly silenced by military counterintelligence. So any real intelligence on what the Americans might be developing would have to come from Soviet agents deep inside the U.S. government. Stalin would order it. And, as if they were activated by an invisible switch, spies from one of the most efficient and ruthless intelligence machines in the world began homing in on the American military bases associated with the Roswell retrieval and the key American military and civilian personnel the Russians knew would have to be involved. The Americans might not have been the most efficient spy catchers in 1947. But Army counterintelligence had been put on alert even before the Soviets knew that a flying saucer had been retrieved. Starting from the central point at the nexus of sensitive New Mexico bases during the summer of 1947, CIC agents questioned everybody who seemed interested in learning about what happened in Roswell. Ask too many questions, and knocking at your door will be a couple of plainclothes investigators who didn't need a search warrant to rummage through your things. So maybe the Army was a little overzealous about their interrogation procedures, but by early August, it began producing results. By the time General Twining was writing his report to Army Air Forces Command in Washington, both Army and Navy intelligence commanders knew that the Soviets had a high-priority operation in place at military bases around the country. Soviet agents were everywhere, Central Intelligence Group Director Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter, a member of President Truman's advisory group on UFOs, informed the president. A top-down counterintelligence operation had to be put in place immediately, he recommended, or every plan the military had to evaluate what they'd retrieved from Roswell would be compromised. There were a million questions. Were those flying objects the prelude to something much bigger? Were they communicating with the Soviets? Were they allied with the Soviets? Were they probing our defenses for a planetary invasion? We had already assumed that the behavior of these aircraft was hostile. But what did they want? Meanwhile, other reports of civilian flying saucer sightings were turning up in newspapers and coming through local police. Even airline pilots were seeing strange lights. There wasn't much time to act. A secret this big about flying saucers was bound to get out and cause untold panic among the civilian population unless an elaborate camouflage was established. And worse, we had to keep the Soviets away from this until we knew what we had. We needed a plan, and right away. Some have said it was Secretary of Defense James Forrestal's idea. Others said the whole scheme belonged to Central Intelligence Director Hillenkoetter. I frankly don't know firsthand, because when the plan was hatched, I was sweating out the end of the summer at Fort Riley, still trying to shake out of my mind the image of that ghoulishly unearthly thing I'd seen floating in its container. But whoever said it first was saying the obvious, according to the people on Eisenhower's national security staff, whom I worked with 6 years later. Maybe it was Forrestal, after all, who was the only person in the cabinet who could have spoken to Truman that bluntly in just a little over 2 years after the man had inherited his office from FDR and was already a very unpopular president. "It's like this," I heard President Truman was told. "We're in a real pickle here. Nate Twining says he doesn't know what the hell this thing is, except that if the Soviets get a hold of it, it'll change the shape of things to come for sure." "You fellas gonna write up some report for me?" the president asked. "General Twining said he'd rather do it as a briefing, sir, for the time being," Admiral Hillenkoetter suggested. "For your ears only. Then we have to get a working task group to manage this whole issue." Maybe the working group, whatever it was going to be called, would come up with a report analyzing the situation as soon as they reviewed what General Twining was putting under lock and key at Wright Field, but nobody wanted to speculate until they knew what was there. "Maybe you should sit down with General Twining first," both Forrester and Hillenkoetter suggested. They knew that Harry Truman liked to get a first-hand report from people who had seen the situation with their own eyes. FDR was corporate and knew how to digest reports. He trusted his subordinates. But Truman was different. He knew how to run a haberdashery store. If a hat didn't fit, he'd have to go back to the factory to find out why. It was the same with General Twining, who'd been at the crash site himself. If Truman wanted answers, he'd have to see it through the eyes of someone who'd been there. "Does he know what these SOBs are after?" Truman asked, referring to the aliens in the crash saucer. "That's one of the questions we want to address," they said. "How do you plan to do it?" Forrestal and Hillenkoetter explained that they wanted the president to hear what General Twining had to say and then convene a group of military, civilian, and intelligence personnel with strong old-school ties of trust for one another. In this way, whatever decisions they made wouldn't have to be memoed all over the place, thus risking the possibilities of leaks and tip-offs to the Soviets. "We don't want the newspapers or radio people getting their hands on any of this," they told the president. "Winchell would crucify me with this if he found out what we were doing," Truman was reported to have said at the meeting. Nobody in the know liked President Truman very much, and he could appreciate it. "It's like the Manhattan Project, Mr. President," Admiral Hillenkoetter reminded him. "It was war. We couldn't tell anyone. This is war. Same thing." Then they explained that after they had convened a working group, they would task out the research of the technology while keeping it from the Soviet spy machine already operating at full bore within the government. "We hide the information from the government itself," the secretary explained. "Create a whole new level of security classification. Just for this," the Central Intelligence Director said. "Any information we decide to release, even internally, we downgrade, so the people getting the information never have the security clearance that allows them all the way to the top. The only way to hide it from the Russians is to hide it from ourselves." But the president was still thinking about the difficulty of keeping an operation this far-reaching out of the news, especially when flying saucers had become one of the hottest news items to talk about. What was he supposed to say when people asked the government about flying disc stories, he asked, pressing for details that still had to be established? How could they research these strange creatures without the news getting out? And how could they analyze the wealth of physical material Hillenkoetter had described to him without bringing in people from outside government? President Truman simply didn't see how the government within a government camouflage idea could work without the whole thing spinning out of control. Despite Forrestal's assurances, the president remained skeptical. "And there's one final point," Truman was said to have brought up to his Central Intelligence Group director and Secretary of Defense. It was a question so basic that its apparent naivete belied an ominous threat that it suggested was just over the horizon. "Do we ever tell the American people what really happened?" There was silence. "Don't ask me how I know. My old friend and enemy from the KGB wouldn't tell me how he knew, and I didn't press him. But accept it as fact from the only source that could know, just as I did back when I was told that neither the Secretary of Defense nor the Director of Intelligence had considered a disclosure like this even a remote possibility." "Well," President Truman said, "do we?" On November 7th, 1944, the day FDR was elected to his fourth and final term, his chief advisor, Harry Hopkins, had described the new vice president, Harry Truman, as a man who couldn't block a hat, but who shouldn't be underestimated. And James Forrestal, the man to whom he was speaking at the time, now understood what he meant as the secretary sat across from the now president, Harry Truman. This was a basic yes-no question, and although Forrestal and Hillenkoetter had a knee-jerk reflex answer, no, Forrestal quickly saw that it wasn't that easy. As wartime administrators, their first response was naturally to disclose nothing, abiding by the old saw that what people don't know, they don't need to know. But President Truman, who had not come from a military background, had seen something neither Forrestal nor Hillenkoetter had seen. If these ships could evade our radar and land anywhere at will, what would stop them from landing in front of the White House, or, for that matter, the Kremlin? Certainly not the U.S. Army Air Force. So what do we say when they land, I'm told, Truman continued, and create more panic in the streets than if we disclose what we think we know now? But we really don't know anything, the Director of Intelligence said, not a thing until we analyze what we've retrieved. But both the Secretary of Defense and Director of Intelligence agreed with President Truman that he was right to be skeptical, especially on his final point about disclosure. So can we postpone coming to any conclusions at least until after you've met with General Twining? Admiral Hillenkoetter said. I think he'll provide some of the answers we're all looking for. While Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter and James Forrestal were briefing President Truman on their plan for the working group, General Nathan P. Twining was completing his preliminary analysis of the reports and materials sent to Wright Field. Almost immediately, he dispatched the remains of the aliens to the Bethesda Naval Hospital and the Walter Reed Army Hospital for further analysis by the two military services. The aircraft itself remained at Wright Field, but, as he would promise in his memo to the Army Air Forces Command, General Twining was preparing to distribute the material from the wreckage among the different military and civilian bureaus for further evaluation. He'd already been cautioned by Admiral Hillenkoetter that new security classifications had been put in place regarding the Roswell intelligence package. No one within the military, other than names he would receive from the president himself, had the full security clearance to learn the complete story about Roswell that Twining would deliver to the president and other members of a working group. Within 3 months after he'd been dispatched to New Mexico to learn what had happened at Roswell, General Twining met with President Truman, as Hillenkoetter and Forrestal had suggested, and explained exactly what he believed the Army had pulled out of the desert. It was almost beyond comprehension, he described to the president. Nothing that could have come from this planet. And if the Russians were working on something like this, it was so secret that not even their own military commanders knew anything about it, and the United States would have to establish a crash program just to prepare a defense. So it was Twining's assessment that what they found outside of Roswell was, in his words, not of this earth. Now President Truman had heard it, he told Forrestal after Twining had left for Ohio, directly from the horse's mouth, and he was convinced this was bigger than the Manhattan Project and required that it be managed on a larger scale and obviously for a longer period. The group proposed by Forrestal and Hillenkoetter had to consider what they were really managing and for how long. Were they only trying to keep one secret, that an extraterrestrial alien spaceship had crashed at Roswell, or were they hiding what would quickly become the largest military R&D undertaking in history, the management of what would become America's relationship with extraterrestrials? General Twining had made it clear in his preliminary analysis that they were investigating the whole phenomenon of flying disks, including Roswell and any other encounter that happened to take place. These were hostile entities, the general said, who, if they were on a peaceful mission, would not have avoided contact by taking evasive maneuvers even as they penetrated our airspace and observed our most secret military installations. They had a technology vastly superior to ours, which we had to study and exploit in case they turned more aggressive. If we were forced to fight a war in outer space, we would have to understand the nature of the enemy better, especially if it came to preparing the American people for an enemy they had to face. So, investigate first, he suggested, but prepare for the day when the whole undertaking would have to be disclosed. This Truman could understand. He had trusted Twining to manage this potential crisis from the moment Forrestal had alerted him that the crash had taken place, and Twining had done a brilliant job. He kept the lid on the story and brought back everything he could under one roof. He understood, as Twining described to him, the strangeness of the spacecraft that seemed to have no engines, no fuel, nor any apparent methods of propulsion, yet out flew our fastest fighters. The odd, child-like creatures who were inside, and how one of them was killed by a gunshot, the way you could see daylight through the inside of the craft even though the sun had not yet risen, the swatches of metallic fabric that they couldn't burn or melt, thin beams of light you couldn't see until they hit an object and then burned right through it, and on, more questions than answers. It would take years to find these answers, Twining said, and it was beyond the immediate capacity of our military to do anything about it. This will take a lot of manpower, the general said, and most of the work would have to be done in secret. General Twining showed photographs of these alien beings in autopsy reports that suggested they were too human. They had to be related to our species in some way. They were obviously intelligent and able to communicate. Witnesses at the scene had reported by some sort of thought projection, unlike any mental telepathy you'd see at a carnival show. We didn't know whether they came from a planet like Mars in our own solar system or from some galaxy we could barely see with our strongest telescopes, but they possessed a military technology whose edges we could understand and exploit even if only for self-defense against the Soviets. But by studying what the extraterrestrials had, we might be able to build a defense system against them as well. At the very least, Twining had suggested the crescent-shaped craft looked so uncomfortably like the German Horton brothers' wings our flyers had seen at the end of the war that he had to suspect that the Germans had bumped into something we didn't know about. And his conversations with Wernher von Braun and Willy Ley at Alamogordo in the days after the crash confirmed this. They didn't want to be thought of as verrückt, but intimated that there was a deeper story about what the Germans had engineered. No, the similarity between the Horton brothers' flying wing and the craft they had pulled out of the Arroyo was no accident. We always wondered how the Germans were able to incorporate such advanced technology into their weapons development in so short a time and during the Great Depression. Did they have help? Maybe we were now as lucky as the Germans and broke off a piece of this technology for ourselves, with an acceleration capability and maneuverability we'd never seen before. This craft would keep American aircraft engineers busy for years just incorporating what they could see into immediate designs. This issue of security was paramount, but so were questions of disclosure, the president reminded him. This thing was too big to hide and getting bigger all the time, while reporters were just like dogs on a scent. So just putting a higher security classification on it and threatening anybody who came too close wasn't enough to hide a secret this big. You couldn't prevent leaks, and eventually it would all have to come out anyway. General Twining should think about that before the group made any final decisions, the president advised. By the middle of September, it was obvious to every member of President Truman's working group, which included the following: Central Intelligence Director Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter, Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, Lieutenant General Nathan Twining of the Army Air Force and then U.S. Air Force Air Materiel Command, Professor Donald Menzel, Harvard astronomer and naval intelligence cryptography expert, Vannevar Bush, Joint Research and Development Board Chairman, Detlev Brock, Chairman of the National Research Council and biologist who would ultimately be named to the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics, General Robert Montague, who was General Twining's classmate at West Point, Commandant of Fort Bliss, with operational control over the command at White Sands, Gordon Gray, President Truman's Secretary of the Army and Chairman of the CIA's Psychological Strategy Board, Sidney Sowers, Director of the National Security Council, General Hoyt Vandenberg, Central Intelligence Group Director prior to Roscoe Hillenkoetter and then U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff in 1948. Jerome Hunsaker, Aircraft Engineer and Director of the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics. Lloyd Berkner, member of the Joint Research and Development Board. Unless this group established a long-term plan for protecting and developing the Roswell project, the secrets would soon leak out. I understand that it was General Twining who pointed out to the group that, in fact, the story had already leaked out. It was leaked, he said, hours after the crash and then retracted. In fact, people were still talking about it in New Mexico. But after the Army's weather balloon story, the national newspapers were treating the flying disc reports as delusions of people who had seen too many Buck Rogers movies. The national press was already doing the committee's work. What was really needed, Twining suggested, was a method for gathering the information about continuing UFO activity, especially crashes, high-probability sightings by pilots or the military, or actual physical encounters with individuals, and surreptitiously filtering that information to the group while coming up with practical explanations that would turn unidentified flying discs into completely identifiable and explainable phenomena. Under the cover of explaining away all the flying disc activity, the appropriate agencies represented by members of the working group would be free to research the real flying disc phenomena as they deemed appropriate. But through it all, Twining stressed, there had to be a way of maintaining full deniability of the flying disc phenomenon while actually preparing the public for a disclosure by gradually desensitizing them to the potential terror of confronting a more powerful biological entity from a different world. It would have to be, General Twining suggested, at the same time both the greatest cover-up and the greatest public relations program ever undertaken. The group agreed that these were the requirements of the endeavor they would undertake. They would form nothing less than a government within the government, sustaining itself from presidential administration to presidential administration, regardless of whatever political party took power, and ruthlessly guarding their secrets while evaluating every new bit of information on flying saucers they received. But at the same time, they would allow disclosure of some of the most far-fetched information, whether true or not, because it would help create a climate of public attitude that would be able to accept the existence of extraterrestrial life without a general sense of panic. It will be, General Twining said, a case where the cover-up is the disclosure and the disclosure is the cover-up. Deny everything, but let the public sentiment take its course. Let skepticism do our work for us until the truth becomes common acceptance. Meanwhile, the group agreed to establish an information-gathering project ultimately named Blue Book, and managed explicitly by the Air Force, which would serve public relations purposes by allowing individuals to file reports on flying disc sightings. While the Blue Book field officers attributed commonplace explanations to the reported sightings, the entire project was a mechanism to acquire photographic records of flying saucer activity for evaluation and research. The most intriguing sightings that had the highest probability of being truly unidentified objects would be bumped upstairs to the working group for dissemination to the authorized agencies carrying out the research. For my purposes, when I entered the Pentagon, the general category of all flying disc phenomena, research and evaluation was referred to simply as foreign technology. Chapter 6, The Strategy. There is an old story I once heard about keeping secrets. A group of men were trying to protect their deepest secrets from the rest of the world. They took their secrets and hid them in a shack whose very location was a secret. But the secret location was soon discovered, and in it was discovered the secrets that the group was hiding. But before every secret could be revealed, the men quickly built a second shack where they stored those secrets they still kept to themselves. Soon, the second shack was discovered, and the group realized they would have to give up some secrets to protect the rest. So they again moved quickly to build a third shack and protect whatever secrets they could. This process repeated itself over and over until anyone wanting to find out what the secrets were had to start at the first shack and work their way from shack to shack until they came to where they could go no further because they didn't know the location of the next shack. For 50 years, this was the very process by which the secrets of Roswell were protected by various serial incarnations of an ad hoc confederation of top secret working groups throughout different branches of the government. And it is still going on today. Were you to search through every government document to find the declassified secrets of Roswell and the contact we maintain with the aliens who were visiting us before and have been doing so ever since, you would find code name project after code name project, each with its own file, security classification, military or government administration, oversight mechanism, some form of budget, and even reports of highly classified documents. All of these projects were started to accomplish part of the same task, manage our ongoing relationship with the alien visitors we discovered at Roswell. However, at each level, once the security had been breached for whatever reason, even by design, part of the secret was disclosed through declassification while the rest was dragged into a new classified project or moved to an existing one that had not been compromised. It makes perfect sense, especially to those of us who understand that the government is not some monolithic piece of granite that never moves or reacts. To those of us inside the military government machine, the government is dynamic, highly reactive, and even proactive when it comes to devising ways to protect its most closely held secrets. For all the years after Roswell, we weren't just one step ahead of people wanting to know what really happened. We were 100 steps ahead, 1,000 or even more. In fact, we never hid the truth from anybody. We just camouflaged it. It was always there. People just didn't know what to look for or recognize it for what it was when they found it. And they found it over and over again. Project Blue Book was created to make the general public happy that they had a mechanism for reporting what they saw. Projects Grudge and Sign were of a higher security to allow the military to process sighting and encounter reports that couldn't easily be explained away as balloons, geese, the planet Venus. Bluefly and Twinkle had other purposes, as did scores of other camouflage projects like Horizon, HARP, Rainbow, and even the Space Defense Initiative, all of which had something to do with alien technology. But no one ever knew it. And when reporters were actually given truthful descriptions of alien encounters, they either fell on the floor laughing or sold the story to the tabloids, who'd print a drawing of a large-headed, almond-eyed, six-fingered alien. Again, everybody laughed. But that's what these things really look like because I saw the one they trucked up to Wright Field. Meanwhile, as each new project was created and administered, another breadcrumb for anyone pursuing the secrets to find, we were gradually releasing bits and pieces of information to those we knew would make something out of it. Flying saucers did truly buzz over Washington, D.C. in 1952, and there are plenty of photographs and radar reports to substantiate it. But we denied it while encouraging science fiction writers to make movies like The Man from Planet X to blow off some of the pressure concerning the truth about flying discs. This was called camouflage through limited disclosure, and it worked. If people could enjoy it as entertainment, get duly frightened, and follow trails to nowhere that the working group had planted, then they'd be less likely to stumble over what we were really doing. And what were we really doing? As General Twining suggested in his report to the Army Air Forces, foreign technology was the category to which research on the alien artifacts from Roswell was to be delegated. Foreign technology was one of the great catch-all terms, encompassing everything from researching French Air Force engineering advances on helicopter blades to captured Russian MiGs flown in from Cuba by savvy pilots who could negotiate our southern radar perimeter better than our own pilots. So what if a few pieces of technological debris from a strange crescent-shaped hovering wing turned up in old files somewhere in the Army's foreign technology files? If nobody asked about it, and nobody did, because foreign technology was just too damn dull for most reporters to hang around, we didn't have to say anything about it. Besides, most foreign technology stuff was classified anyway, because it dealt with weapons development we were hiding from the Soviets, and most reporters knew it. Foreign technology was the absolute perfect cover. All I had to do was figure out what to do with the stuff I had, and General Trudeau wasn't in the mood to wait any longer. "Come on, Phil, let's go," the general's voice suddenly filled the room over the blown speaker hum of my desk intercom. I put down my coffee and huddled up the stairway to the back door of his inner office. This was a routine that repeated itself 3, sometimes 4 times a day. The general always liked to get briefed in person, because even in the most secure areas of the Pentagon, the walls tended to listen and remember our conversations. Our sessions were always private, and from the way our conversations bounced back and forth among the different topics, if it weren't for his 3 stars and my pair of leaves, you wouldn't even think you were listening to a pair of Army officers. It was cordial and friendly, but my boss was my boss, and even after we both retired like 2 old war horses put out to pasture, our meetings were never informal. "So now you've figured out how the package arrived," he asked me before I sat down. I'd figured it out by going through all the files I could get my hands on and tracing the path of the Roswell information from the 509th to Fort Bliss and from there to Wright Field, the dissemination point. General Trudeau motioned for me to sit down, and I settled into a chair. It was already 10:30 in the morning, so I knew there'd be at least 2 other sit-down briefings that day. "I know it didn't come by the parcel service," I said. "I don't think they have a truck that big." "Does that help you figure out what we should do?" he asked. Actually, knowing how the material got into the foreign technology files was critically important because it meant that it was dispatched there originally. Even if it had been neglected over the years, it was clear that the foreign technology desk of the R&D system was its intended destination, part of the original plan. And I even had the documents from General Twining's own files to substantiate this. Not that I would ever have revealed them at the time. General Twining, more than anyone else during those years after the war, understood the sensitive and protected nature of the R&D budget. And now that I understood how the camouflage was to take place, I also saw how brilliant the general's plan was. R&D, although important and turning over records like topsoil from the Nazi weapons development files captured after the war, was a kind of backwater railroad junction. Unnoticed by most officers on their way up to the top, and not called upon in the late 1940s to do much more than record-keeping, it turned out to be the perfect hideaway when the CIA hirelings came sniffing through the Pentagon in the early 1950s looking for anything they could find on the Roswell technology. Unless they were part of the working group, from the start, not even members of the Eisenhower White House National Security Staff knew that R&D was the repository of the Roswell artifacts. I was there. I can vouch for that. In fact, it wasn't until I saw the files for myself and reverse-traced their path to my doorstep that I realized what General Twining and the working group had accomplished. By the time I'd arrived at the White House, though, it was all ancient history, People were more worried about the sighting information deluging Blue Book every day than they were about the all-but-forgotten story of Roswell. But my mind was drifting, and the general was still speaking. He wanted to know what my research had uncovered and what I had learned about Roswell during my years at the White House. What I'd seen. How far the concentric circles of the group and the people who worked for them went. "Phil, we both know that the package you have is no surprise," he said flatly. I didn't respond substantively, and he didn't expect me to, because to do so would have meant breaching security confidentiality that I'd sworn to maintain when I was assigned to the NSE staff at the White House. "You don't have to say anything officially," he continued, "and I don't expect you to. But can you give me your impressions of how people working for the group talked about the package?" "I wasn't working for the group, General," I said, "and whatever I saw or heard was only because it happened to pass by, not because I was supposed to do anything about it." But he pushed me to remember whether the NSC staff had any direct dealings with the group and how much the central intelligence staffers at the White House pressed to get any information they could about what the group was doing. Of course I remembered the questions going back and forth about what might have happened at Roswell, about what was really behind Blue Book, and about all those lights buzzing the Washington Monument back in 1952. I didn't have anything substantive to tell my boss about my involvement, but his questions helped me put together a bigger picture than I thought I knew. From my perspective in 1961, especially after reviewing everything I could about what happened in those days after the Roswell crash, I could see very clearly the things that I didn't understand back in 1955. I didn't know why the CIA was so aggressively agitated about the repeated stories of flying saucer sightings, or why they kept searching for any information about the technology from Roswell. I certainly didn't volunteer any information, mainly because nobody asked me about seeing any parts of the cargo as it passed through Fort Riley. I just played position, representing the Army as the military member of the National Security Staff, but I listened to everything I heard like a fly on the wall. General Trudeau's questions forced me to ask myself what the big picture was that he saw. He was obviously looking for something in my descriptions of the architecture of the group as I'd learned it from my review of the history and of the staffers on the lower security classification periphery as I understood it from my experience at the White House. He really wanted to know how the bureaucracy worked, how much activity the group itself generated, what kinds of policy questions came up in my presence, and whether I was asked to comment informally on anything having to do with the issues of the group. Did Admiral Hillenkoetter host many briefings for President Eisenhower, where Generals Twining, Smith, Montague, and Vandenberg were present? General W.B. Smith had replaced Secretary Forrestal after he committed suicide during the second year of the Truman administration. Were Professor Menzel and Drs. Bush and Berkner visitors to the White House on regular occasions? Did they meet at the White House with Admiral Hillenkoetter or the generals? What was the level of presence of the CIA staffers at the White House through all of this? And did I recognize anyone from the Joint Research and Development Board or the Atomic Energy Commission at any briefings chaired by Admiral Hillenkoetter? Through General Trudeau's questions, I could see not only that the general knew his history almost as well as I did about how this original group was formed and how it must have operated, but he also had a sense of what kind of problem was facing the military R&D and how much leeway he had to solve it. Like most ad hoc creations of government, the group must have had at some point become as self-serving as every other joint committee eventually became the longer it functioned and the more its job increased. As the camouflage about flying discs grew, so did the role of the group. Only the group didn't have the one thing most government committees had, the ability to draw upon other areas of the government for more resources. This group was above top secret and officially had no right to exist. Therefore, its functions grew over the next 10 years to encompass the investigations of more flying saucer sightings and the research into more encounters with alien aircraft or with the extraterrestrials themselves. Its resources became stretched so thin that it had to create reasons for drawing upon other areas of the government. Accordingly, task-defined subgroups were formed to handle specific areas of investigation or research. These had to have had lower security classifications, even if only because the number of personnel involved couldn't have been cleared that quickly to respond to the additional work the group was taking on. In fact, the work of the group must have become unmanageable. Bits and pieces of information slipped out, and the group had to determine what it could let go into the public record and what had to be protected at all costs. As in the story about the shacks, the group members retreated to create new protected structures for the information they had to preserve. The official camouflage was sagging under the weight of the information the group had to investigate and the pressure of time they were allotted. Soon the military representatives found, just as we did in Korea, that they really couldn't trust the career intelligence people, especially the CIA, because they seemed to have a different agenda. Maybe the military became resistant to giving up all the information it was collecting independently to the central group. Maybe in the absence of any actual legislation establishing how the group's work was to be paid for, the military saw valuable and fundable weapons opportunities slip through its fingers to the CIA's budget. Maybe, and I know this is what happened, a power struggle developed within the group itself. The whole structure of the working group had changed, too, since the late 1940s when it was formed. What started out as a close-knit group of old friends from prep school had become an unmanageable mess within 5 years. Many pieces of the pie were floating around, and the different military branches wanted to break off chunks of the black budget so that you needed an entire administration just to manage the managers of the cover-up. Therefore, at some point near the middle of the Eisenhower administration, seams opened up in the grand camouflage scheme where nobody knew what anybody else was doing. Because of the cover-up, nobody really had a need to know, so nobody knew anything. The only people who wanted to get their hands on information and hardware belonged to the CIA, but nobody, even those who vaguely understood what had happened 14 years earlier, trusted the CIA. Officially, then, nobody knew nothing, and nothing happened. Through the 1950s, a cascade effect developed. What had started out as a single-purpose camouflage operation was breaking up into smaller units. Command and control functions started to weaken, and, just like a submarine that breaks up on the bottom of the ocean, debris in the form of information bubbled up to the surface. Army CIC, once a powerful force to keep the Roswell story itself suppressed, had weakened under the combined encroachments of the CIA and the FBI. It was during this period that my old friend J. Edgar Hoover, never happy at being kept out of any loop, jumped into the circle and very quietly began investigating the Roswell incident. This shook things up, and very soon afterwards, other government agencies, the ones with official reporting responsibilities, began poking around as well. For all intents and purposes, the original scheme to perpetrate a camouflage was defunct by the late 1950s. Its functions were now being managed by a series of individual groups within the military and civilian intelligence agencies, all still sharing limited information with each other, each pursuing its own individual research and investigation, and each, astonishingly, still acting as if some superintelligence group was still in command. But like the Wizard of Oz, there was no superintelligence group. Its functions had been absorbed by the groups beneath it, but nobody bothered to tell anyone because a supergroup was never supposed to exist officially in the first place. That which did not exist officially could not go out of existence officially. Hence, right through the next 40 years, the remnants of what was once a supergroup went through the motions, but the real activities were carried out by individual agencies that believed on blind faith they were being managed by higher-ups. Remember the lines of cars at gas pumps during the fuel shortage of 1973 when one driver, thinking a gas station was open, would wait at a pump, and within 15 minutes, scores of other cars pulled up behind him? Lines a mile long formed behind pumps that were never opened because there was no gas. That's what the great flying saucer camouflage was like by the time President Kennedy was inaugurated. "There's nobody home, Phil," General Trudeau told me as we compared our notes at that morning's briefing. "Nobody home except us. We have to make our own policy." I was a soldier and followed orders, but Trudeau was a general, the product of a political process, stamped with a congressional approval and reporting to a civilian executive. Generals are made by the government, not by the army. They sit between the government and the vast military machine, from the Army Chief of Staff all the way down to brigadiers at bases around the world. Generals create the way military policy is supposed to work. And on the morning of this briefing over cups of coffee in his inner office of the third floor of the Pentagon, Lieutenant General Trudeau was going to make policy and do the very thing that over 10 years of secret working groups and committees and research planning had failed to do: exploit the Roswell technology. "I need you to tell me you found a way to make something out of this mess," General Trudeau told me. "There must be some piece of technology in your file that'll make a weapon that we can use for one of our helicopters." "What do I have in there, Phil?" Then he said, "Time is now of the essence. We have to do something because nobody else will." In the great cloud of unknowing that had descended upon the Pentagon with respect to the Roswell package, the five or six of us in the Navy, Air Force, and Army who actually knew what we had didn't confide in anyone outside his own branch of the military, and certainly didn't talk to the CIA. So in a way that could only happen inside the military bureaucracy, the cover-up became covered up from the cover-up, leaving the few of us in the know free to do whatever we wanted. General Trudeau and I were all alone out there insofar as the package went. Whatever vestige of the group remained had simply lost track of the material delivered to Foreign Technology 14 years earlier. And the general was right. Nobody was home, and our enemies inside the government were capitalizing on whatever information they could find. The Roswell package was one of the prizes, and if we didn't do anything with it, the Russians would, and they were onto us. Our own military intelligence personnel told us that the Soviets were trafficking so heavily in our military secrets that they knew things about us in the Kremlin before we knew them in Congress. The Army at least knew the KGB had penetrated the CIA, and the leadership of the CIA had been an integral part of the working group on flying discs since the early 1950s. Thus, whatever secrets the group thought they had, they certainly weren't secrets to the KGB. But here's what kept the roof from falling in on all of us. The KGB and the CIA weren't really the adversaries everybody thought them to be. They spied on each other, but for all practical purposes, and because each agency had so thoroughly penetrated the other, they behaved just like the same organization. They were all professional spies in a single extended agency playing the same intelligence game and trafficking in information. Information is power to be used. You don't simply give it away to your government's political leadership, whether it's the Republicans, the Tories, or the Communists, just because they tell you to. You can't trust the politicians, but you can trust other spies. At least that's what spies believe, so their primary loyalty is to their own group and the other groups playing the same game. The CIA, KGB, British Secret Service, and a whole host of other foreign intelligence agencies were loyal to themselves and to the profession first, and to their respective governments last. That's one of the reasons we in the military knew that the professional KGB leadership, not the Communist Party officers who were only inside for political reasons, were keeping as much information from the Soviet government as the CIA was keeping from our government. Professional spy organizations like the CIA and the KGB tend to exist only to preserve themselves, and that's why neither the U.S. military nor the Russian military trusted them. If you look at how the great spy wars of the Cold War played out, you'll see how the KGB and CIA acted like one organization. Lots of professional courtesy, lots of shared information to make sure nobody got fired, and a few human sacrifices now and then just to keep everybody honest. But when it came down to loyalty, the CIA was loyal to the KGB and vice versa. I believe they had a rationale for what they did. I know they thought the rest of us were too stupid to keep the world safe, and that by sharing information, they kept us out of a nuclear war. I believe this because I knew enough KGB agents during my time and got enough bits and pieces of information off the record to give me a picture of the Soviet Union during the 1950s and 1960s that's very different from what you'd read on the front page of the New York Times. CIA penetration by the KGB and what amounted to their joint spying on the military was a fact we accepted during the 1950s and 1960s, even though most of us in the Pentagon played spy versus spy as much as we could. Those of us, like me, who'd gone to intelligence school during the war and knew some of the counter-espionage tricks that kept the people watching you guessing, we would change our routes to work. Always used false information stories as bait to test phones we weren't sure about. Swept our offices for listening devices. Always used to code when talking with one another about sensitive subjects. We had a counterintelligence agent in the military attaché's office over at the Russian consulate in Washington whose friends in the Soviet Army trusted the KGB less than I did. And if my name came up associated with a story, he'd let me know it. But he'd never tell the CIA. Believe it or not, in the capital of my very own country, that kind of information helped me stay alive. It was very disconcerting that the CIA had a tail on me all throughout my 4-year tenure at the White House. I was mad about it, but there was nothing much I chose to do. Then, when I came back to Washington in 1961 to work for General Trudeau, they put the tail back on, and I led them down every back alley and rough neighborhood in D.C. that I could. He wouldn't shake, so the next day, after I told my boss what I was going to do, I led my faceless pursuer right to Langley, Virginia, past the sputtering secretary, and straight into the office of my old adversary, the director of covert operations, Frank Wisner, one of the best friends the KGB ever had. I told Wisner to his face that yesterday was the last day I would walk around Washington without a handgun. And I put my .45 automatic on his desk. I said that if I saw his tail on me tomorrow, they'd find him in the Potomac the next day with two bloody holes for eyes. That is, if they bothered to look for him. Wisner said to me, "You won't do that, Colonel." But I reminded him very pointedly that I knew where all his bodies were buried, the people he'd gotten killed through his own ineptitude, and worse, his cooperation with the Russians. I'd tell his story to everyone I knew in Congress. Wisner backed down. Subsequently, on a trip to London, Wisner committed suicide and was found hanging in his hotel room. I never did tell his story. 2 years later, in 1963, one of Wisner's friends at the agency told me that it was all in good fun, Phil. Part of an elaborate recruitment process to get me into the CIA after I retired from the Army. But I went to work for Senator Strom Thurmond on the Foreign Relations Committee and then Senator Richard Russell on the Warren Commission instead. Our collective experience dodging the CIA and the KGB only meant that when General Trudeau wanted the CIA kept out of our deliberations at all costs, it was because he knew that everything we discussed would be a topic of conversation at the KGB within 24 hours, faster if it were serious enough for the KGB to get their counterparts in the CIA to throw a monkey wrench into things. How do I know all this? The same way I know how the KGB stayed one step ahead of us during the Korean War and were able to advise their friends, the North Koreans, how to hold POWs back during the exchange. We had leaks inside the Kremlin just as they had leaks inside the White House. What General Trudeau and I knew in Army R&D, our counterparts in the Navy and Air Force also believed. The CIA was the enemy. You trust no one. So when it became clear to the general, even before 1961, that no one remembered what the Army had appropriated at Roswell, whatever we had was ours to develop according to our own strategy. But we had to do it so as not to allow the CIA and ultimately our government's enemies to appropriate it from us. So when General Trudeau said we have to run radio silent on the Roswell package, I knew exactly what he was talking about. Logic, and clearly not my military genius, dictated the obvious course. If nobody knows what you have, don't announce it. But if you think you can make something out of what you have, make it. Use any resources at your disposal, but don't say anything to anyone about what you're doing. The only people in the room when we came up with our plan were the general and myself, and he promised, "I won't say anything if you don't, Phil." "There's nobody in here but us brooms, General," I answered. So we began to devise a strategy. "Hypothetically, Phil," Trudeau laid the question out, "what's the best way to exploit what we have without anybody knowing we're doing anything special?" "Simple, General," I answered. "We don't do anything special." "You have a plan?" he asked. "More of an idea than a plan," I began, "but it starts like this. It's what you asked. We don't want anybody to think we're doing anything out of the ordinary. We don't do anything out of the ordinary. When General Twining made his original recommendations to President Truman and the Army, he didn't suggest they do anything with this nut file other than what they ordinarily do. Business as usual. That's how this whole secret group operated. Nobody did anything special. What they did was organize according to a business plan, even though the operation was something that hadn't been done before. That's the camouflage. Don't change a thing, but use your same procedures to handle this alien technology." "So how do you recommend we operate?" he asked. I think he already figured out what I was saying, but wanted me to spell it out so he could start moving my nut file out of the Pentagon and out of the encroaching shadow of the CIA. "We start the same way this desk has always operated, with reports," I said. "I'll write up reports on the alien technology just like it's an intelligence report on any piece of foreign technology. What I see, what I think the potential may be, where we might be able to develop, what company we should take it to, and what kind of contract we should draw up." "Where will you start?" the general asked. "I'll line up everything in the nut file," I began. "Everything, from what's obvious to what I can't make heads or tails out of. And I'll go to scientists with the clearance who we can trust, Oberth and von Braun, for advice." "I see what you mean," Trudeau acknowledged. "Sure, we'll line up our defense contractors, too. See which ones have ongoing development contracts that allow us to feed your development projects right into them." "Exactly. That way the existing defense contract becomes the cover for what we're developing," I said. "Nothing is ever out of the ordinary, because we're never starting up anything that hasn't already been started up in a previous contract. It's just like the big mix and match," Trudeau described it. "Only what we're doing, General, is mixing technology we're developing in with technology not of this earth," I said. "And we'll let the companies we're contracting with apply for the patents themselves." "Of course," Trudeau realized, "if they own the patent, we will have completely reverse-engineered the technology." "Yes, sir, that's right. Nobody will ever know. We won't even tell the companies we're working with where this technology comes from. As far as the world will know, the history of the patent is the history of the invention. It's a perfect cover, Phil, the general said. Where will you start? I'll write up my first analysis and recommendation tonight, I promised. There's not a moment to lose. The photographs in my